Hello and welcome to the Science Magazine podcast for June 12, 2009. I'm Robert Frederick. This week, deforestation in the Amazon leads to a boom and bust cycle, China's efforts to stamp out Kaschenbeck disease, and measuring the charge states of individual atoms. All this and more, plus a wrap-up of some of the latest science news, including a story about shining lasers on light bulbs from our online daily news site, Science Now.
Support for the Science Magazine podcast is provided by AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, advancing science, engineering, and innovation throughout the world for the benefit of all people. AAAS, the Science Society, at www.aaas.org.
When people deforest a new area in the Brazilian Amazon, new research shows that the communities on the deforestation frontier first go through a period of rapid economic growth, a boom in their economy, followed by an economic downturn or a bust shortly thereafter. In particular, Ana Rodriguez and colleagues report in a paper that people in communities that go through this boom and bust development end up with very nearly the same standard of living, life expectancy, and literacy rates that they had as before deforestation. I spoke with Rodriguez from her office at the University of Cambridge.
People typically assume that deforestation in the Amazon or in other regions is a path for human development, that it will reduce biodiversity, but it will bring at least people's improvement in their well-being. And we tested these assumptions for the Brazilian Amazon, and we found that it's not the case. While there is indeed an increase in human well-being measured through life expectancy, income, and education in the beginning of the deforestation, on the onset of the deforestation wave, but this is not a sustained development, and it actually goes back to previous levels once the deforestation wave goes through. So we're suggesting that there should be a better model of development for the region, and the challenge is one where we can have a model where we can simultaneously have an improvement in human well-being, which is sustained, but without depleting the region's natural resources.
How long has widespread deforestation been going on in Brazil?
It started pretty much when Europeans got in. widespread deforestation. With Portuguese colonization in the 1500s, most of the, deforestation started on the Atlantic forest. But the large-scale deforestation in the Amazon is actually relatively recent. And most of the deforestation will have taken place in the past few decades.
And there's sufficient data over that time period to measure life expectancy changes?
So what we did was actually not measure changes over time periods, but measuring them over space. So we compared different parameters of human well-being, life expectancy, education, and income across the Brazilian Amazon in regions which were ahead of the deforestation frontier, so regions which are still quite pristine regions, in the middle of the deforestation frontier, and regions which are already post-frontier. So that's what we compared, was how these values change over space rather than over time. We use space as a proxy.
Is there general consensus about who in the population is doing the actual work of deforestation?
It's a quite complex mix of players. People come to the frontier for all sorts of reasons. It includes landless people. It includes investors, people who come with some money who want to expand that money. It includes people who come for the gold mining, people who come for the logging, people who come to establish pasture land. So it's actually quite a diversity of people. But from other studies, not from our own, it seems to be the case that most people who come to the frontier are actually quite poor. The first people that come in and the people who actually cut most of the woods are people who come without land and which are trying to establish land for themselves.
Is it possible then that the presence of these migrants is a confounding factor in calculating these three factors, life expectancy, literacy, and standard of living?
Population changes have definitely an effect. We try to investigate some of what that effect could be. It doesn't seem to explain all of it. So one possibility could be that people, as they come in, they could actually bring with them a higher life expectancy, a higher income, and higher education levels. But it doesn't seem to be supported by other studies, which actually say that people who come in are typically actually quite poor. So migration doesn't seem to explain on its own the boom that we see in life quality. On the other hand, it almost certainly has an effect in the bust side of the effect, where population increase is almost certainly contributing to the decline in overall population life standards.
So deforestation as measured across hundreds of municipalities in the Brazilian Amazon, is that right?
Yes.
Goes through a boom and bust cycle, and so isn't, your team argues, good for the long-term financial sustainability of the region. What then is a better model? You mentioned a better model for the region. What would that look like?
Well, we believe that the challenge, we don't know what the solution is, but we think that the challenge is a model which doesn't require depleting the natural resources. So we think that this pattern we're seeing of boom and bust is reflecting the overexploitation first and then the exhaustion of natural resources, which include obviously timber. As timber declines, there's no more timber to explore, but also land quality, soil fertility, which also declines in many parts of the Amazon after a few years of use. So we're seeing that this exhaustion of the natural resources is probably associated with the bust. So a better model would be one which doesn't lead to the long-term exhaustion of the natural resources that led to the boom in the first place. And we believe now actually the conditions are starting to be created for such a model where the forest is actually valued more alive than felled. And this is through processes, ongoing negotiations, for example, which are starting to value the forest for its carbon storage capacity and compensating countries for non-deforesting by non-having carbon emissions from deforestation. Important negotiations on these will happen at the end of the year, associated with the United Nations Framework Conference on Climate Change. And we hope that actually might change quite a lot of the dynamics in Brazil.
Ana Rodriguez, thank you very much.
Thanks very much. It's been a pleasure.
Ana Rodriguez of Cambridge University is lead author of a paper on the boom and bust development patterns across the Amazon deforestation frontier. A new report assessing U.S. science and math education is drawing attention this week for its call for a complete cultural shift in the U.S. education system. The report was released jointly by the Carnegie Corporation of New York and the Institute for Advanced Study. Here with more about it is Science's Policy Forum editor, Brad Weibel.
The two organizations convened scientists, educators, business leaders, and public officials to discuss ways to increase access to high-quality education in science, technology, engineering, and math, commonly called STEM Ed. Science Editor-in-Chief Bruce Alberts was among the members of the commission. The resulting report, called the Opportunity Equation, builds on previous studies, but also makes new, explicit recommendations for action in four priority areas. The first recommendation is that all students in the United States need excellent STEM Ed to be central in their schooling. Second, educators should use shared, common standards to assess math and science teaching and learning. Third, teacher preparation, recruitment, and professional development must be beefed up. And fourth, schools and school systems need overhauls so that STEM Ed can be delivered more effectively. In short, the report recommends that the U.S. educational system needs a cultural shift to serve students effectively, but commission members maintain it can be done. To that end, the commission assembled a list of 65 groups that have agreed to act together on some of the report's recommendations. Emphasizing the practical, ready-for-action nature of the recommendations, Nobel laureate Harold Varmus said during the press conference, "Every element has been tested somewhere and shown to be feasible." U.S. Education Secretary Arne Duncan echoed that sentiment, saying the challenge now is to take those islands of excellence and make them systems of excellence. One of Secretary Duncan's suggestions for enhancing STEM Ed is to recruit highly qualified individuals from industry, particularly scientists who may have lost their jobs in the economic downturn, and have them become teachers under an alternative certification process.
That was Policy Forum editor Brad Weibel with a policy update from Science and the AAAS Center for Science, Technology, and Congress. Like osteoarthritis, Kaschenbeck disease is a disease of joint cartilage that can make it agonizing to move, particularly where pressure on the joints is involved, such as in walking. Unlike osteoarthritis, the incidences of Kaschenbeck disease are limited only to a small region in Asia. But scientists aren't quite sure why. In this week's Science, news writer Rich Stone reports on what scientists know about Kaschenbeck disease and how the Chinese government is taking steps to eradicate the disease among its population. I spoke with Stone from his home office in Beijing.
There's a disease that few people have heard of outside of China called Kaschenbeck disease. It strikes quite a large number of people. Hundreds of thousands of people in China's heartland suffer from this disease. It's an ailment that most closely resembles osteoarthritis. except while osteoarthritis tends to strike people over the age of 60. This disease can strike children as young as 2 or 3 years old. What's new about this disease, it's mostly a good news story. China has been quite successful in reducing the incidence of the disease, and they are making a new push now to try to completely eliminate new cases over the next decade. The Chinese government is launching a $240 million initiative that aims to stamp out the disease completely.
Now, is that by using some sort of treatment, or you said reduce the incidence? What does that mean?
So reducing the incidence, it means trying to prevent new cases. And the Chinese government has determined that the most effective strategy to avoid this disease is to basically raise people out of poverty.
What in particular about being poor has led to the spread of this disease?
Well, it might sound that reducing poverty is a fairly diffuse goal, but I think that reflects the fact that scientists don't know precisely what causes Kaschenbach disease. There are three main hypotheses. One is a very curious correlation that the incidence of disease, if you overlay a map of selenium-deficient soil in China, that map corresponds very closely to where you find Kaschenbach disease cases. So that is one possibility, that an inadequate intake of that trace element might play a role. A second idea is that researchers have found that grains in the area, so cereals, barley, tends to be contaminated with a variety of different kinds of funguses. And some of the mycotoxins isolated from these funguses in cell culture tend to reproduce the same sort of damage they see at the tissue level in Kaschenbach victims. So that's a second hypothesis. A third idea is that it may just be poor quality drinking water. People in the countryside, in this part of China, often drink water that has quite a bit of organic matter, and the organic matter hasn't settled out. And fulvic acid produced by the organic matter might also have some causal role for this disease.
Now, with these different hypotheses, do scientists think that the end result here will be finding that one of them is the cause of the disease, or that there's perhaps some combination of these causes that together are causing the disease?
Yeah, certainly some researchers believe that it might not be just a single cause, and Chinese researchers and some people who work for the Kaschenbach Disease Foundation have taken a stab at a grand unified Kaschenbach disease theory. So they've suggested that free radicals generated by mycotoxins and fulvic acid could damage cells in cartilage that leads to the symptoms that you see with Kaschenbach, and that people with an impaired antioxidant defense due to trace element shortages would then be more prone to this. But there's still a lot of questions which don't really add up. One researcher has pointed out that if unquenched free radicals were the sole culprit, smokers should be at a higher Kaschenbach disease risk. But as far as they know, that hasn't been seen. And also, because the disease strikes children, you wouldn't expect that children would have accumulated so much damage from free radicals. So that has led people to believe that there could be an altogether unknown factor out there.
What more precisely has the Chinese government tried in stamping out the disease?
They've taken a lot of different approaches. Some work in some villages and some don't. So they have supplemented the diets of villagers with sodium selenate tablets. They have replaced grains with clean grains. They have provided clean water. And where those measures don't work, they have simply moved people. So in the last 2 years, in one province, Shaanxi province alone, they moved approximately 80,000 people.
Doesn't moving whole villages of people suggest the Chinese government believes that environmental factors, whatever they might be, are the cause? Perhaps not poverty, but where those people are located?
Well, the disease is certainly confined to a particular part of China, but major cities in this area don't report Kashinbek cases. And the feeling of researchers here is that there are some factors associated with poverty, such as poor diet, which make people much more likely to get Kashinbek disease.
So the relocation effort isn't simply just a relocation, but working to change dietary habits, things like that, with these villagers.
Well, firstly, what the Chinese government is trying to do is to simply move people out of areas where whatever in the environment is causing Kashinbek disease happens, to get them away from that trigger. And then in the process of doing that, if they could help raise people out of poverty, that could serve to further prevent the possibility of new Kashinbek cases.
Is there any effort to move people into the cities?
They've encouraged people in Kashinbek disease areas, if they have relatives in big cities, to move in with them. But when it comes down to it, a lot of the people in the villages are older people. They've lived there their whole life, and they're really reluctant to relocate. So I think it's been a pretty difficult challenge in persuading people that it is to their benefit to relocate. So I think that the bottom line is that the variety of approaches that the Chinese government has taken to this disease, either the trace element supplementation, providing clean grains, clean water, and then simply moving whole villages, that combination has worked. The disease prevalence is certainly falling quite fast, and one Chinese scientist was so bold as to say that he doesn't believe that there will be any new Kashinbek cases by the year 2020. So that's certainly good news. But in these last decade or so, when they do anticipate seeing new cases, the more scientists can learn about this disease, the more likely they could get some benefits, some lessons that could apply to global problems like osteoarthritis.
The idea being that if they eliminate the incidence without figuring out the cause, then it could come back.
I don't think that they're too worried about it making a comeback. I think what a lot of scientists are worried about is that if there are any unique insights that this disease could have for much more important global threats, they do want to seize the chance to try to learn as much as possible about Kashinbek disease prior to it dying out.
Rich Stone, thank you very much.
Thank you, Rob.
Science's Rich Stone writes on steps China's government is taking to eradicate Kashinbek disease. The idea behind molecular electronics is to build electronic systems literally out of molecular building blocks. Already, scientists have created, manipulated, and probed some of these molecular building blocks using scanning tunneling microscopy, or STM, and atomic force microscopy, or AFM. And recently, scientists have even imaged immobilized molecules on bulk insulators at submolecular resolution through an imaging technique called non-contact atomic force microscopy. Now, in a paper in this week's Science, Leo Gross and colleagues report that in addition to imaging single atoms or molecules, they can also detect the charge state of single atoms by cooling the whole setup down to near absolute zero. Essentially, the team has created a new tool for manipulating individual molecules and atoms and for performing reactions of interest not only to those in molecular electronics, but also for those interested in catalysis, material synthesis, and photovoltaics. I spoke with Gross from his office at IBM's Zurich Research Laboratory in Switzerland.
So what we showed in this paper was the measurement of atomic charge states of single atoms using atomic force microscopy. And this is very important because the charge state is important in many processes in physics and chemistry. And to be able to measure that with atomic force microscopy allows us to perform these measurements on insulators. And these are technologically very relevant materials. So just to give a few examples, it would be very nice to determine the charge state for catalytic processes, where this plays an important role, determining the reactivity of certain sites. But also in photovoltaics, it would be nice to measure the charge distribution of a charge transfer complex with atomic precision.
How did you and your team modify the atomic force microscope to get the necessary resolution to probe the charge state of a single atom?
Okay, so actually we come from scanning tunneling microscopy. So this is a technique where you measure the current between tip and the sample to control the height of the tip. And we now use the technique that's called the Q-plus sensor. So this is a very small tuning fork where, like in wristwatches, where one prong of the beam is fixed and the other one holds the tip. And so we were able to incorporate this sensor into our already existing low-temperature STM setup. And the benefits of this Q-plus sensor is that this can oscillate at very small amplitudes because it's a very stiff cantilever. So we were able to record and measure with oscillation amplitudes of only 0.2 angstrom. So it's about a tenth of an atom's diameter. And these small oscillation amplitudes are important to reach our higher lateral resolution, so to image with atomic resolution.
With the low temperature setup, that cooling of the sample, and presumably also meaning a high vacuum as well, was necessary to get this resolution?
Exactly. So we are working at ultra-high vacuum, usually at a base pressure of 10 to the minus 10 millibar and better, and at temperatures of liquid helium, so about 4.2 Kelvin. And the tuning fork sensor, this Q-plus sensor, is very suited to work at these low temperatures. And the low temperatures are needed not only for the stability of the measurement apparatus, but also the whole system. The single atom on the insulating layer would not be stable at room temperature.
What material was that single atom? What material did you choose to probe and why?
So there was previous work, and we choose single gold and single silver atoms on a double layer of sodium chloride. And this system was known from previous investigation of the same group, from Yasha Repp and Gerd Meyer mainly. And it was known that the gold atom in this system can be charged negatively and the silver atom can be charged positively, meaning by one electron charge. And so investigating these two different atoms, we had a system where we could prepare a neutral, a negative, and a positively charged single atom.
Now, with these particular materials, though, there's something special about gold and silver. They don't, in single atom form, become superconducting at low temperatures. Does that have any impact on other materials that you might probe with the same technique?
I don't think this has any importance or relevance for us.
Okay, so the lessons learned about the charge state could be applied to other materials. As you said, you can apply to insulators as well. It's not just relevant for gold and silver and possibly copper,
correct,
which don't become superconducting.
Correct. So the question would maybe be if these charge states also exist for other atoms and species. And yes, they do, but it depends on the whole system. So the atom, it plays a role, but also the insulating film, its material and thickness, and also the underlying substrate plays an important role. And then the position of the energy levels with respect to each other, the electron affinity and ionization energy of the atom and the Fermi energy of the substrate and the thickness and band gap of the insulating layer, all this together determines which charge states will be stable. And this can be different for any different system. So you can tune, actually, these charge states and their stability by choosing different materials for substrate, insulating layer, and atom.
The atom being the atom embedded into the double layer of sodium chloride.
Actually, it's not embedded. It sits on top. And we actually also know the position. It sits on top of a chlorine atom.
Okay. Now, you mentioned in your paper that this isn't the best or the most ideal way of measuring these atoms.
Yeah, but for this system, it works with STM, where you have this thin sodium chloride layer. You can still tunnel through it. So this has been done with STM. But now AFM offers the possibility to go on bulk insulators, thicker insulating film and bulk insulators. And this is important if you want to investigate, for example, charge transport in planar molecular films or single molecular devices or molecular networks, then you should have really a thicker insulating film where you have no leakage of electrons through the insulating layer.
So what's next then for your team is making further modifications to this microscope to probe other materials, or what?
Yeah, so I hope that we'll not need too many further modifications, but that we can apply this machine now on thicker insulating films or bulk insulators. So that's one direction we are going. And also now we want to really investigate molecules and molecule metal complexes using this system and hope to increase resolution in terms of spatial resolution, but also be able to image partial charges and charge distributions in molecules and metal molecular systems. Also, what we're really interested is to measure charge transport and charge distribution in such networks, and there we hope that we can apply this technique of measuring the charge state of a single atoms and then use these atoms or larger clusters and connect them with molecules which we try to investigate. And then by measuring the charge distribution over such systems, to actually observe charge transport in these planar devices. But therefore, we'll have to work on thicker insulating film.
Leo Gross, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Leo Gross of IBM Research is lead author of a paper on measuring the charge state of an atom by non-contact atomic force microscopy. Read the paper and a related perspective in this week's Science. Finally today, David Grimm, editor of Science's online daily news site, Science Now, is here with a wrap-up of some of the latest science news. One of those stories is scientists shining lasers on light bulbs. Dave, why do that?
Well, it has to do with increasing the efficiency of light bulbs. And as time goes on, the light bulbs that maybe you and I have become very accustomed to growing up, what are called incandescent bulbs, the sort of round bulbs that give the nice yellow glow that a lot of people really like, are slowly going the way of the horse and buggy. And that's because these incandescent bulbs are not very energy efficient, and they're gradually being replaced by new types of fluorescent bulbs and halogen bulbs that are a lot more energy efficient.
So shining a laser on them somehow makes them more efficient?
Well, that's what these researchers wanted to find out. And the reason they even thought of lasers in the first place is because this team had been doing experiments with these ultra-fast laser pulses. And what they found is when they, you know, shot a few pulses at various pieces of metal, they could actually change the chemical properties of the metal without melting the metal. And where light bulbs come in is light bulbs have these filaments, these, you know, sort of coil-like structures that you see in the bulb, and these are made out of metal. And the researchers had noticed that when they fired these laser pulses at various types of metals, that with some metals, they could actually increase the amount of radiation that the metals absorbed. And obviously, when you're talking about light bulbs, you don't want to absorb energy, you actually want to emit energy. But they figured that maybe they could, if they could make a metal absorb a lot of energy, maybe they could make a metal also emit a lot of energy. And that's exactly what they found. They took an off-the-shelf light bulb, fired these ultra-fast laser pulses at it. It was a 60-watt bulb, and they were able to increase its brightness so that it resembled a 100-watt bulb just by shining these laser pulses at it. And what was really cool was that even though this light bulb was all of a sudden emitting a lot more light than it did before, it wasn't consuming any more energy than it did before. So they had made these light bulbs, which at baseline aren't very energy efficient, a lot more energy efficient.
Any commercial application possible here? I mean, ultra-fast lasers aren't something that you find at your local hardware store.
That's true. And these lasers are very expensive. But the researchers say this is actually could be commercialized very quickly. Even though these lasers are expensive, all it would take would be a few of these lasers set up in a factory. And once you've got the lasers in place, you're just, you know, shuttling a bunch of light bulbs in front of them. And they say this could actually be scaled up in the near term if people are actually interested in doing this.
Any other potential applications to this other than increasing the efficiency of light bulbs?
Well, really anything that deals with metals could be fundamentally changed by this technology. One of the experts on this article raised the possibility of using these lasers to increase the efficiency of, say, solar energy panels or even radar detectors.
Okay. So what's next?
Well, while we're on the topic of radar detectors, how about planes detecting birds? And this next story has to do with the U.S. Airways flight that went down in the Hudson River in mid-January of this year. And as you recall, Rob, this was considered a very heroic landing by the pilot because even though the airplane crash landed into the Hudson, the pilot brought it down in a very controlled way. Nobody was killed in the crash. So it was a very fortunate outcome for this airplane.
And investigators had ruled that it was a flock of birds that the plane ran into.
Right. Very soon afterwards. In fact, the pilot, I believe it even radioed in that he had hit a flock of birds. And indeed, when the investigators started looking at the plane after they had drug it out of the river, they saw feathers in the engine. So that seemed to confirm that it was a bird strike that had brought the plane down. But there were a lot of questions. What type of bird was it? Where had these birds come from? And figuring this out is actually really important. I didn't realize this, but bird strikes are actually a really big problem for airplanes. Since 1988, there's been 229 deaths, airplane deaths, associated with bird strikes. These birds have destroyed more than 200 aircraft, and they've caused over $1 billion in damage to airplanes. So this is actually a really big and a really relatively common problem.
Why so important then to find out where the birds came from rather than just look at ways to keep them away from airports?
Well, obviously that's important too, but you want to know where these birds are coming from because you have a lot of cases where you have birds nesting near airports. And if you can figure out what type of birds are posing the biggest threat to airplanes or where these birds are coming from, it could potentially help you manage these bird populations and keep them away from airplanes in the first place.
So what did scientists find out here?
What they did was they did this actually very detailed forensic analysis where scientists first collected these bird feathers that the investigators had taken out of the engine. They did DNA analysis. They did isotopic analysis, a lot of different things they were looking at in these feathers. And the first thing they figured out was that the feathers belonged to Canadian geese, which were actually one of the prime suspects. So it confirmed that. And beyond that, they wanted to figure out where these birds came from. And to do that, they did what's called isotopic analysis, and they look for these versions of hydrogen. And these versions of hydrogen, which are called isotopes of hydrogen, vary throughout the country. So depending on what these geese are eating or even where they're nesting, they're ingesting and incorporating different levels of different hydrogen isotopes into their feathers, and the researchers can measure this. And what they found was that the birds actually come from a place in Canada called Labrador, and that they winter in New York, but that these particular birds were probably migrating out of New York just around the time of the plane crash because New York had been experiencing a lot of snowstorms, and these birds were looking for a more pleasant place to spend their winter. So we know a lot more about the birds that brought down this plane than we did before.
So at that time of the year, wildlife managers wouldn't be expecting to see a whole flock of birds up in the air in New York City.
Right. And the idea is, you know, as we know more about these birds, we can do a better job of keeping them away from airplanes. And experts are also saying that the crash suggests that more research needs to be done into bird detecting radar to try to prevent a lot of these crashes in the first place.
So maybe those ultra-fast lasers will help?
Could be.
Okay, so last story. What's this one about? I see you brought a sound file with you.
I did. See if you can guess what this is, Rob.
It doesn't sound human.
It's not. It's actually a young orangutan laughing. And you'll notice right off the bat, it doesn't sound like a young human laughing, right?
Here it is again. No, it doesn't.
What you'll notice is that there is a lot of sort of more grunting there. There's a lot more inhaling, whereas human laughter tends to be a lot more vocalized. A lot of the ha-ha, you know, we sort of associate with laughter. So for this study, researchers wanted to do really a comprehensive study of as many primates as they could, study their laughter, and compare it to human laughter to learn more about how laughter may have evolved in the first place.
I had thought that scientists had theorized that humans were the only creatures that laughed.
Well, that was actually a prevailing theory. And actually, one theory said that only humans can laugh because something about us being bipedal, something about the structure of our bodies, the way we're oriented, allows us to laugh. But over the past few years, researchers have noticed sounds that sound like laughter coming from various primates. You know, primates, it turns out, really love to be tickled. Gorillas, bonobos, chimpanzees, if you rub a feather against their feet, they make these sounds that researchers have identified as laughter, even though it doesn't sound like human laughter. So it turns out humans aren't the only creatures that laugh. And the trick now is trying to figure out, well, how did this laughter evolve in the first place? And that's what this study is all about.
Something about the biology or the construction of our vocal cords, or what?
Well, it's really more about analyzing the sound and seeing if we can see any similarities between humans and some of the other primates, and using that similarity to trace back maybe a common ancestor that may have laughed like we do or like our primate relatives do. And so for this study, researchers visited a lot of zoos and sanctuaries around the world and tickled young primates and recorded the vocalizations. And so they heard some things like, you know, the audio clip we played earlier. And what they noticed overall was that a lot of the primates sounded like the noises in that clip. There was a lot of grunting, a lot of inhaling. So laughter that didn't really sound a whole lot like the vocalized human laughter. But it wasn't always the case. In fact, with gorillas and bonobos, the researchers were surprised to hear more breathy laughs, so some exhaling when these creatures were laughing. And similar sounds have been documented in chimpanzees before. So there, even though overall there's not a lot of similarities, the researchers did see some similarities between humans and other primates in terms of laughter.
So how far back? I mean, is the idea to look at the common ancestor of both modern primates and us?
Well, exactly. I mean, the idea is to now find a common ancestor, knowing which creatures laugh most similarly to humans and tracing that back. And when the researchers did this, they hypothesized that laughter evolved about 10 to 16 million years ago in a common ancestor of humans and other primates. And they speculate the laughter probably sounded a bit like the laughter here. A lot of grunting, more inhalation, so something that didn't really sound very similar to a human laugh, and that the human laugh really evolved over time. It appears to be an exaggeration of the laugh of other primates. So that may give clues to how it evolved in the first place.
Okay, well, thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Rob.
So what other stories are you looking into for Science Now or on the policy blog, Science Insider?
Well, Rob, for Science Now, we're looking into stories about how typhoons can trigger earthquakes and how stress really does turn your hair gray. And on the policy blog, Science Insider, we're continuing our almost daily coverage of swine flu, and also a story about how President Obama is trying to support science in the Islamic world. He's made a lot of proposals recently about sending scientific diplomats over and other things, and we're investigating just how he plans to do that. So be sure to check out all these stories on the site.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the online daily news site of science. You can check out the latest science news, plus find a link to the science policy blog, Science Insider, at sciencenow.sciencemag.org. And that wraps up the June 12th, 2009 Science Magazine podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, please write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org. The show is a production of Science Magazine with the support of AAAS, the Science Society. Jeffrey Cook composed the music, and I'm Robert Frederick. On behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, thanks for joining us.